from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's forum program, an international council of Amnesty International recently recommended a new policy decriminalizing prostitution. The goal is to protect the human rights of sex workers who may experience rape, physical abuse, and denial of basic services like housing and health care. But opponents say the policy would also protect pimps, brothel keepers, and buyers of sex. We'll discuss whether or not people should have the right to buy and sell sex. Forum is up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. With an International Council of Amnesty International calling for worldwide decriminalization of prostitution last month in Dublin, advocates for decriminalization are once again promoting the benefits to public health and a lessening of sexual assault, which they believe, along with opening up the denial of basic services such as housing and health care, will accompany decriminalization of the world's oldest profession. On the other side of the debate are those who argue that decriminalization only leads to more sex trafficking, an argument, along with moral and criminal concerns, which served to convince San Francisco voters back in 2008 to vote down a measure to decriminalize. In Sweden, the purchase or buying of sex is criminalized while individuals are permitted to sell sex, the idea being that demand will diminish, though sex worker groups argue that such a policy serves only to criminalize sex work. Canada followed the 1999 Swedish model and included no selling of sex anywhere near children's schools or parks where children play, which opponents argue only drives sex work underground. This forum hour, we want to take up the debate. And joining us here in studio, we want to welcome Rachel Moran. She is author of Paid For, My Journey Through Prostitution, founder of Space International, which advocates for the abolition of the sex trade. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Maxine Dugan here in studio with us, a working prostitute and president of Erotic Service Provider Legal, Educational and Research Project. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. Actually, you were with us when the Proposition San Francisco came up. Glad to have you back. Also glad to have Andrea Powell with us, who joins us by phone this morning, co-founder and executive director of Fair Girls. And Fair Girls is a nonprofit that seeks to prevent the exploitation of girls worldwide with empowerment and education. Andrea Powell, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. And we also want to welcome Swanee Hunt, who has been on forum before. She chairs Demand Abolition, which combats the demand for purchased sex. She's the former U.S. ambassador to Austria and on the faculty at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And Swanee Hunt, good to have you back with us.
Michael, it's good to talk to you.
Welcome. Welcome to all of you. And let me begin, if I may, with Rachel Moran, who, as I said, is here in studio with us and who I was saying before we went on the air has written a really powerful book about her own life in prostitution, very troubled family background, homeless, life, addiction, abuse, violence. It's quite a story, but with hope in it as well. And it's your hope to really do something about prostitution and actually helped bring about legislation in Ireland.
Well, actually, we've been successful with that, Michael, thankfully, after a very long 5-year struggle. And we've got the legislation that we're looking for in the north. And the bill has just been published where I'm from in the Republic.
Well, congratulations on that. And let's talk about what that means. We're talking about a Swedish model here, basically?
Absolutely.
And it means sex to buy, but sex not to sell.
It means that any individual, which is gender neutral, would not be criminalized for prostituting, but that anybody purchasing sexual access to somebody would be facing criminal charges.
And that includes brothel keepers, pimps, etc.
Of course, yes. And it also, very importantly, I believe, opens up avenues for people who want to exit. And we've seen in just about every statistic out there that the majority of people in prostitution do want to leave. So I think it's very important to provide them with the means to do so. And under the Nordic model, you have help with housing, education, training, childcare, addiction, a whole range of services that would help you to get out.
Is there, in your mind, a kind of indissoluble connection between sex trafficking and prostitution?
everybody who's ever been sex trafficked in the history of the world has been trafficked into prostitution. So to try to pretend that they're not intrinsically linked is just nonsensical, in my view.
And you also say in your book that prostitution is not a choice.
It's not a choice in the way that I've never seen any woman actively choose prostitution from a situation where she had a range of valid choices. It's always, from everything I've seen over the course of 7 years, being something that's just taken on as a last resort. So I don't think that you can call that a choice in the absence of viable alternatives.
Maxine Dugan, you take a somewhat different view. I mean, you feel not only is it a choice, but maybe a constitutional right?
Right. So, you know, I've been working as a prostitute for 25 years now, and I pretty much plan on working for another 25 years. And, you know, we tried to decriminalize prostitution here in the city in 2008 with Prop K. And we had so much trouble getting money to move that ballot measure because people did not want to have their names disclosed on the financial disclosures that are mandatory for ballot measures. And even though they really supported prostitution being decriminalized, including our customers, they didn't feel like they had the means to step forward and do that because of the social stigma of association. So we formed the nonprofit, the Erotic Service Providers Legal Education and Research Project. And, you know, it's taken us many years to get here to be able to file our lawsuit, which we filed in March of this year in federal court against the California State Attorney General and her official capacity as such.
Not only against her, but it's four other state attorney generals, I believe, isn't it?
That's right. It's a San Francisco, Marin County, Sonoma County, and Alameda County. And we are saying that the prostitution law violates our constitutional right to be able to negotiate for our own labor and our own safe work condition. And it violates our right to associate, and it violates our right to be able to gain access to equal protection under the law. So we have three plaintiffs who would like the right to work as prostitutes, as well as a customer who would like, or a guy who would like to be a customer, the right to be able to purchase. So our case right now is in front of Judge White over in Oakland, and we're waiting for the first decision in that round.
Essentially, you're saying adults can make their own decisions about this, and it ought to be a privacy right, a free speech right, a due process right, and all along the constitutional pattern there. And I guess you would agree then with Alaskan former sex worker Tara Burns, who's gotten a good deal of attention, who says that you have to go through state law. You can't go through federal law on this. You have to use the courts.
Yes. I mean, we have been, as you know, Michael, we did Prop K here in the city in 2008. We were the opponents of Prop 35 at the state level. We have, our class of worker has not had any luck in getting the attention of state legislatures to hear our concerns about the criminalization of prostitution laws and the effects that it has on our community.
And what about sex trafficking? Rachel says there's a definite link that prostitution, if it's criminalized in terms of the buyer, can lead to more and more sex trafficking.
Yeah, we oppose that view. We think that by decriminalizing prostitution, that people involved in prostitution who shouldn't be there, who don't want to be there, can have an easier means to step out and make those statements. In fact, even under criminalization right now, we see that really our customers are the first responders to people who don't want to be involved in the sex trade. The customers are often the ones who provide the money or, you know, the transportation or a phone to get those people onto their next right thing.
Let me go back to you, Rachel Moran. I'd like to get your story a little bit more, too, in this, what you went through on a personal level. But obviously, you're not in agreement with Maxine.
On that point, absolutely not. Every stat I've ever looked at contradicts the notion that the Johns help women who've been trafficked out of prostitution. I personally know a young woman who was sex trafficked from Eastern Europe into Ireland. She was bought and sold into brothels all over Ireland, north and south, for years. Not one single John, as you call them here, had anything to give her but unwanted sex, even though she was trembling, crying, and quite obviously did not want to be there. That girl was beaten so badly that she will have epilepsy till the day she dies from the brain injury she received in those brothels. The idea that men behave like white knights in prostitution and help women out who don't want to be there is...
It's a myth?
It's an absolute myth, and it's a dangerous myth, I have to say.
Maxine?
Well, I mean, that's just not my experience. You know, my experience is that, you know, many customers have helped people move on to their next right thing, as well as the workers themselves.
So when we find people
Who are in the business, who don't want to be in the business, you know, you help them get them whatever it is that they need.
In the case of younger people,
you know, it's really a lack of ID. They may not have ID to be able to gain access to a job. They might not have access to financial services. We know here in the city there's a big struggle over housing. So, you know, having proper housing, you know, those are some real issues for everybody.
Oh, they are real issues. Let me bring Andrea Powell into this. She's co-founder and executive director of Fair Girls. You work with a lot of these young girls who are trafficked into prostitution, and shed some light for us on the connection between what may be, at least in many people's minds, a necessity to decriminalize versus what goes on in terms of trafficking.
Yes, thank you. So you're correct. Fair Girls works with over 100 young women and girls here in the United States alone who are trafficked primarily through sex trafficking. And over the course of the last 10 years, what we have consistently seen is that when the young women we work with are arrested for charges of either prostitution or solicitation or other associated crimes, the impact on their life is very negative and very profound. And that ranges from not being able to gain other types of employment, also getting access to public housing. We've had young women in our program not be able to attend college, and consistently seeing that over half of the young women we serve have those experiences started to make us question the criminalization of prostitution in this country and how that negatively impacted those who were actually trying to help. That being said, based on who we serve, the girls who we're working with want to exit sex work. However, what we're seeing is that those arrests really disable them from doing that. And that's really kind of where we're at. And I think we have a long way to go to understand what a path would look like here in the United States of making sure that we're protecting those who are potentially victims of trafficking while giving the access to dignity, respect, and services to those who are willingly involved in sex work. And that, I think, is really the challenging distinction. But at the core of what we are trying to advocate right now is that we want to ensure that no one involved in sex work is unduly arrested, loses access to health, housing, and jobs. And so that's really where we're at and why we are, you know, so committed to protecting not only our clients, but anyone who's a sex worker from arrest.
So you would like to essentially decriminalize those who are seeking sex. You're on board on that score.
Absolutely.
And how do you distinguish between non-consenting sex workers or sex workers who are under duress or against their will when in so many instances they have someone who is controlling and manipulating them, some predator who makes them essentially answer in the ways that that predator wants them to answer?
So you're absolutely right, and I think it was Rachel who made this point. The concept of choice is incredibly difficult and nuanced. In this arena, over 70% of the girls who we serve were involved in the foster care system. 90% of the girls we serve have experienced prior sexual abuse prior to becoming involved either in consensual sex work or in a sex trafficking situation. And often those experiences have some fluidity. So we work with a number of young women who, because of a lack of opportunities, became involved in some form of commercial sex and then ultimately was either introduced to someone who pretended to be a boyfriend or offered to so-called help them and then ultimately was put into a trafficking situation. And again, those who we serve at Fair Girls are trying to exit commercial sex. So we're not looking at the entirety of the population. But the distinction that is really important is anyone who's under the age of 18 is considered a victim of sex trafficking, regardless of their perspective on whether or not that's something that they would like to be involved in. And then when you're talking about adults, you have to look at those elements of force, fraud, and coercion. And that being said, unlike the movie Taken that's so popular, and and looking at trafficking, the majority of the girls we serve were not kidnapped. They were not beaten into a trafficking situation, but they were slowly manipulated, offered false promises, or threatened with arrest and stigma. And in fact, one of the number one avenues that pimps use to control their victims is saying, if you come forward, no one will believe you and you will be arrested. Juxtaposing that, which we hear consistently from our clients, that the fact that half of our clients are in fact arrested, that just validates what the pimps are saying. And so that's really something to be thinking about as we're looking at the possibility of decriminalization here in the United States, and how can we give back the dignity and the access to services to anyone who's involved in sex work, whether they are a victim of trafficking, which of course is Fair Girls' concern, or there's someone who's willingly involved in sex work. And we would like for anyone who's in these situations to have a myriad of opportunities. And if you have an arrest record, your access to those opportunities and ability to move forward in life is very limited.
And Andrea Paul is the co-founder and executive director of Fair Girls, and they're a nonprofit that seeks to prevent exploitation of girls worldwide with empowerment and education. Swanee Hunt, as I said, chairs Demand Abolition, which combats the demand for purchased sex. She's also former U.S. Ambassador to Austria and is now on the faculty at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And Ambassador Hunt, let's get you on the record here. We heard from Rachel Moran that there are perhaps no white knights. And there's a study in the Journal of Interpersonal Violence, which I know your group has supported and has come under fire. We can talk about that, too. But it seems to indicate that there aren't very few white knights, or certainly that many of the Johns, as they're called, are for the most part not necessarily, how shall we put this, not necessarily looking out for the interests of those that are servicing them. And in fact, maybe violent, I think, is what another conclusion.
Sometimes they're violent, sure. But I tell you, when you look at the demographics, 85% of the men in this country do not buy other people's bodies. They never have. 85%. So we're only talking about maybe 15 million guys, which seems like a huge number. In fact, it is. So what that means is, and they've bought it sometime in their life. That means, I know about maybe 50 survivors. I don't think I know any pimps, but I know probably hundreds of guys who buy. And the highest frequency, according to our research, the highest frequency of buyers, and I mean they're buying 40 to 60, 70 times a year, they have an average income of $120,000. They're white. They live in the suburbs and have children. So here's what gets to me, Michael. This is really a matter of privilege, and it's a gender-based violence. So you have guys, and they're lawyers, and they're at your Thanksgiving table, and they're at church, or synagogue on the pew behind you. So I'm not trying to demonize people. I really am not, but I will demonize the whole profession. And, I'm very happy for you, Maxine, if this is a choice that you feel great about, but you are a tiny exception. And when you're making public policy, which is what I'm involved in at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, when you're making public policy, you don't protect the rights of a tiny minority when the evidence is crushing of the damage to the majority. In fact, just think about if Toyota had some cars and some of the brakes didn't work. I mean, if you had 10 of that model, they would recall thousands because you protect the rights of the group that is being harmed.
Are the sex worker and sex worker advocacy groups, though, generally more on Maxine's side? It seems to be the case.
They're both. The survivors are organizing as well in terms of those who have been pulled into the trade. Andrea, I really appreciated what you described, because that is my experience as I meet with one survivor after another, after another, after another. They talk about not just themselves, but about the women that they know. And by the way, Backpage now has 1.5 million sex ads every month in our country. And I promise you that those women are not the majority there by choice.
What is Backpage? I'm sorry?
Backpage. Backpage, the online the online.
Oh, I'm not familiar. You know, but if you're saying essentially, aren't you, that if you legalize prostitution or decriminalize it, it would facilitate more exploitation, more sex trafficking?
The legal attracts the illegal. And we're not talking about a zero sum here. The buying of sex is actually an activity that can grow in a man. And so I'm really focusing on the men here because, you know, if you put a woman on the stand and say, have you ever been the victim of force, fraud, and coercion? I mean, give me a break. You know, have you ever been manipulated psychologically? That's what coercion is. Well, why would you re-traumatize her? The guys are breaking the law. It's against the law everywhere in this country except a few counties around Las Vegas. It's against the law, and we have a rule of law, supposedly, in this country, and we're not enforcing it. We're picking up about 10 women and girls for every one man. That has to be reversed. And when we do, we will be moving toward protecting this vast number, this vast proportion of women and girls who are not Maxine.
So do you like the Nordic model, or do you think it should stay as criminalization as it is here in the United States, except for those counties in Nevada?
The beauty is that all four of us on the phone want the decriminalization of the women and girls.
But the problem is here, Michael, is our group is the only one who are actively moving towards decriminalization of prostitution with our court case. So all these other people here can say, you know, they support decriminalization of the workers, but they have yet to include in any of their policy proposals that statement. In fact, their policy proposals say the opposite. Their policy proposals have recriminalized prostitution, including the youth, even though in the 2013 reauthorization of the Victim Authorization Act, you know, Senator Leahy made a resolution that said, you know, people under 18 should not be arrested for prostitution. So they are still being arrested for prostitution.
Let me ask Ambassador Hunt, we're coming up on a break here, about response to what they are doing on her end. Yeah.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about in terms of the policy proposals. I mean, I'm quite involved in policy. And, you know, I really don't know what you're talking about. That I don't know anyone who is saying that we ought to be arresting women and girls.
Well, that is what's really going on. And your policy proposals call for, you know, abolishing the prostitution industry. Isn't that right?
We're talking about decriminalizing the women and girls and putting the accountability for the harm where it belongs.
But that's not what you're
saying. I'm coming up on a break, and I have to give the phone number because there are a lot of people who probably will want to join this conversation.
Sure.
And let me give you an opportunity to do that now with the number to call. That number is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement. In fact, invite it. If you have questions or comments or simply want to go on the record with your own opinion, please feel free to call us. 866-733-6786, talking about decriminalizing the sex trade, which essentially a consul of Amnesty International is advocating. You can put in your own two cents here. You can also do it by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, a consul of Amnesty International. I want to make that clear. It's a consul of Amnesty International recommending a new policy decriminalizing prostitution, and its goal is presumably to protect the human rights of sex workers who may experience rape, physical abuse, and denial of basic services like housing and health care. And opponents are saying this policy would also protect pimps, brothel keepers, and buyers of sex. And we're discussing whether or not people should have the right to buy and sell sex, or perhaps separate those two. Ambassador Swanee Hunt with us this morning, chair of Demand Abolition, which combats the demand for purchased sex, and Andrea Powell also with us by phone this morning, co-founder and executive director of Fair Girls, a nonprofit. And with us in studio, Maxine Dugan, a working prostitute and president of Erotic Service Provider, Legal, Educational, and Research Project, and Rachel Moran, who is author of Paid For, My Journey Through Prostitution, now with Space International, which he founded, an advocate for the abolition of the sex trade. I'm going to read some emails here before I go to your phone calls. Listener writes, shame on Amnesty International. Again, Let's make clear that it's not a final decision. It's a council recommendation of Amnesty International for decriminalization. But this listener writes, we already know that legalization only makes trafficking and exploitation easier and certainly doesn't make women any safer. And considering that a large number of women in prostitution started by being forced into it and also have a history of sexual abuse, we should be doing more to prevent exploitation, not less. We should be following Sweden's model, whereby selling sex is not criminalized, but buying sex is illegal and enforced. And please, please, please stop referring to victims of human trafficking or children as prostitutes. They are prostituted children or victims. Rich writes, a friend of mine went through a nasty divorce and lost a lot of his wealth. He now contracts with a rental girlfriend from the Philippines. She works a month on and takes some time off to go home, works on her terms. They do normal relationship things such as dinner, movies, etc., and both are happy with this relationship. The relationship could be called human trafficking, but it is not hurtful to either party, and both are happy. Another listener says, jail is not the solution. Decriminalization will allow those who willingly choose the profession without fear of prosecution or exploitation from criminals because they would be under the full protection of the state. Those who are victims of traffickers can testify without fear of deportation and a criminal record, and therefore they would be more willing to testify against their exploiters. Also, decriminalization will allow those with addictions to seek help if they want it. A few more online comments. This is Sam, who writes, it is just stupid to punish sex workers for the sake of stopping trafficking. A well-regulated and open system of prostitution is a far superior way to prevent sex trafficking than throwing prostitutes and johns in jail. Of course, there are terrible brothels and terrible johns, which is why this industry should be brought into the open so that legitimate sex workers can ply their trade in the open. As you can see, there's a whole range, as we could have expected, of opinion, though many are saying that decriminalization is following a certain kind of pattern here, with decriminalization of marijuana being very much in the news and also same-sex marriage being very much in the news, that this decriminalization of prostitution following perhaps that pattern. But another listener writes, I don't feel I, as a former homeless teen and a woman who has engaged in what is defined as commercial sex, should be forced to have my life narrative defined by others. Amnesty International's decision, again the council, to support decriminalization is not about calcifying dominant male entitlement to purchase sex from victimized slaves or misogynistic capitalism. It's about generating necessary international dialogue on the authentic differences between sex trafficking and sex work. I worked my way off the streets via the sex industry. Yes, I may have been exploited, though I have become empowered. And on Facebook, Paul asks, is Amnesty International's expectation that the same people would be involved in the trade and act better once it was legal? Let me go to your phone calls, and we begin, Saul, with you. Good morning. Saul's calling us from Seattle. Hi.
Good morning. My name is Saul Feiner, and I am a provider from Seattle, Washington. And my question is focused more towards Ms. Moran and Ms. Hunt. They seem to be indicating that the idea of a, quote, happy hooker is atypical or a myth. But you have one there in the studio with you and Ms. Dugan, and I'm another one on the phone, and I've done extensive research, and I haven't really found much in the way of studies that have been done to show that there's any real strong empirical evidence that Ms. Dugan and I are the minority.
An absolute avalanche of evidence that's been conducted for decades to suggest that yourself and Ms. Dugan would be in the minority. Now, you know, if you are comfortable, happy, doing what you do, that's well and good. And if you were prostituting under the model that we're struggling for, you'd still be able to do that. What we're trying to do is open up avenues for the vast majority who don't want to be prostituted. And let me say, while I'm speaking, in relation to the Amnesty decision, the mistakes of New Zealand, Germany and Amsterdam, Holland, have already proven that decriminalising pimps and johns and brothel keepers massively inflates the market. And where you inflate prostitution, of course you inflate the abuse that goes along with it. And that's one of our major objections to what Amnesty are talking about doing.
Well, that's in direct opposition to what the actual research does show,
that
both in Germany,
Maxine,
and in New Zealand, which is that
people
who don't want to be involved in prostitution don't have to be arrested in order to get out. And that's very important. The other thing that's really important to notice here is that, you know, this business of, you know, calling people privileged, you know, I'm not sitting on the board of the Harvard governance, you know, policy. You know, I'm not on a book tour. You know, I have
been struggling for my rights
for all of these years, and I have the right, and my sisters and brothers have the right to stand in solidarity and
what demand you do not that our have the right to do, Maxine, is to shut
violated.
Down the voices of the majority who are exploited.
It's
usually
not about
underage,
the majority or the minority. That's pitting. That's
you
pitting
don't
people
have that
against
right,
each other. And
we
that's
go back
what
to the essential
do.
Question. We've got dueling research here, and maybe Swanee Hunt, you want to weigh in with Andrea Powell on what the research does or doesn't show.
Sure. Interpol, which, of course, is the international organization working on organized crime, says that sex trafficking brings in between $8 and $12 billion annually. And the you know, this is second only to the drugs, the illegal drugs, and it's on a par with the sale of arms. So, you know, I'm very happy for the caller who says, you know, she's happy with, you know, her work. But you really do, according to the research, represent a very small amount. And again, public policy cannot be oriented to simply saying that whatever you want, you may have when it violates the rights of others. And
could you just cite the research that you've alluded to? I mean, so listeners can find it online or hunt it down?
Sure. Could I instead, because I have like a list of maybe 15 different sources, and so
give me your best source, perhaps.
It would be the Department of Justice and...
Oh, no, wait. The Department of Justice has a disclaimer on their website because their numbers about how many people are involved in trafficking are so elusive. The Department of Justice themselves has produced, you know, reports recently that have said that they don't have any real numbers, especially for the underaged. So when you don't have any real numbers, you can't be passing policy like our government has recently, where they allotted $1.5 billion to the new anti-trafficking initiative that's going to make heroes. That's what the program is called. It's called the Heroes Program out of vets.
Well, I think Ambassador Hunt had another point she wanted to make, too, here. And you can cite any other source you want to, Swanee Hunt.
Sure. And may I encourage people to get these sources from our website, because there's quite a list on demand abolition.
Can you give up the website? That would be helpful. Yeah.
Sure. It's demandabolition.org.
Okay.
I listened very carefully to the people who were calling and writing in, Michael, and they kept repeating a misunderstanding. All four of us agree. The good news is all four of us agree. The women and girls who are being prostituted should not be arrested, should not be charged with anything, certainly not in prison. So let's not get that confused. We're focusing on the men who are fueling the market.
Well, let's not be confused that people like you who are not subjected to the policies that you're advocating for shouldn't be advocating for policies that you are not going to be subjecting yourself.
Maxine, well, let me bring, Rachel,
go ahead. Why don't we bring in Andrea Powell first, though, before we go to you, Rachel. Andrea Powell, let's hear you on this, please.
Yes, hi. You know, I've been also listening to what the variety of callers and emails are saying, and they said a lot. But I wanted to loop back to a couple of points. And one is that, you know, in this country, we have a very high demand for sex, just like you see around the world. And right now, we have a huge number of women and girls and men who are involved in sex work, and that ranges from consensual sex work all the way to a sex trafficking situation. And from my experience working directly with hundreds of young women and girls who wanted to exit that industry, no one had a good experience with a pimp or someone who was trying to control them and control their money. And so many of the girls we served have said that they have tried to exit those situations. They tried to reach out to those who buy sex and have found that those individuals frequently are not willing to assist them because they themselves are afraid of being arrested. The majority of the girls we serve, and unfortunately I don't have a good data set on this from our client data at this time, But the majority of the girls that we talk to say that their sexual assaults and their abuse actually took place at the hands of those who were buying sex, and they were not able to report that because they were afraid of being arrested. And the few men who they actually did try to reach out and get help from have said, well, I would help you, but I also don't want to be arrested. And so we keep coming back to this core element here of the criminalization of the so-called industry. And, you know, I think that those who are involved have a range of experiences. But what I understand from the amnesty policy is that they are by no means advocating for avenues in which sex trafficking itself can proliferate. They are by no means advocating for pimps and those who exploit anyone involved in sex work to have better access.
Quite the contrary. I read the language, and it's right. very much exactly. in opposition to that. Yes.
I'm trying to make this a non sequitur, but I want to look back to this conversation around Backpage, because I want those who are listening to be very clear that Backpage.com is currently the...
That's a classified ad thing. I didn't even know what it was.
Right, exactly. And so what they are currently doing is they are hiding behind what's called the Communications Decency Act to protect themselves, and also claiming that they are just publishing content. But 99% of the girls who we serve at Fair Girls were sold on Backpage.com.
There was a whole debate about this about Craigslist,
right,
in fact,
right.
on
I
this
promise
program.
I'm going to finish this in just a second. But what I'm trying to say is that if we could regulate places like Backpage, and there's been a huge advocacy movement, Ambassador Hunt, my organization, Fair Girls, and others have been very involved, but if we can better regulate those websites to ensure that there's age verification, there's identity verification, that there's better access for those who are involved to get out, and more consistent reporting from Backpage to law enforcement when they identify a potential victim, I think that we can start to shift to a situation in which those who are involved in sex work willingly have their rights protected, but those
well,
who want to get
I,
out...
Well, right,
hold
just,
on
a
second. We have a lot of
that.
Callers, and I want to get to them, but Rachel Moran had a point that she wanted to make here. Rachel mm-hmm. Moran.
What I want to say is that we have been instrumental in moving the Nordic model. We, in the group that I work with, Space International, and we've been instrumental in moving this model across numerous countries now, including Sweden, Norway, Iceland, Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland and Canada. And what I can tell you is that in every one of those countries, the police have stated, told the government directly that organised criminals are absolutely riven in this industry. The industry is just proliferated right through from start to finish with organised crime. So if anybody thinks that you can protect people in prostitution by protecting pimps from the law, I don't know what planet they're
but
on.
But that's not what Amnesty is advocating
Actually,
for.
It is.
Amnesty
Actually
is
it
talking
is.
About decriminalization
has,
across the board.
If you would stop interrupting
we,
me,
we
even,
have, we
you've
have
interrupted
to have the
me
right
several
to
times.
Well,
I'm going
to
interrupt both of you because, hold on a second,
condition.
I'm going to interrupt both of you because we have a lot of callers here and I want to go to them. And let me do that. Kimberly is next. Kimberly, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I haven't heard anybody who advocates for arresting the clients talk about what they are doing to end poverty, because poverty is really the driving force between coercive labor in all sectors. Also, I work in the industry, and one of the things that we do to keep each other safe is to share an apartment, or also we refer our clients to each other. Like, when we know a client is safe, he's not a psycho and he's not a cop, then we would like to share them with our friends to help keep them safe too. The truth about what these people are advocating is that this in-demand model labels us as forces and defines us as brothel keepers because we share apartments or because we share clients. And what's happening is these laws are being used against the workers, against the women. So when we're committing a simple misdemeanor prostitution charge at the state level, they are enhancing these charges to felonies because of in-demand-style principles.
Yeah, an important point, Kimberly, and I thank you for that, because in England, for example, they have been advocating that sex workers should not work alone, but the problem would be, you know, that could be perhaps interpreted as a brothel. Let me get another caller on here. Micah, hi, you're on.
Yes, I've been on both sides. I'm a former sex worker, and I also am a sex customer. And one thing that needs to be said is that the European sex trade is very, very different than the American sex trade. And what we are talking about here is rights for Americans and rights for American women and men to sell sex and buy sex in a safe way so that no one is victimized and so that no one is having the horrible experiences that they do in Europe, which is not the same market at all.
So, right. Mike, I thank you for that call. I said there may be cultural differences here, and that kind of echoes it. But let me get
Michael, I've got a, there are a dozen women in our group. Five of them are from five different U.S. states. So the idea that there's some a crew of violent perverts in Europe and none in the U.S., I'm sure our U.S. women could
nobody would imply such a thing. We got a host of perverts in this country, rest assured. But I'm also struck by...
Well, we just had the Folsom Street Fair yesterday. I mean, so we celebrate that kind of sexual diversity here in San Francisco.
We also celebrate the diversity of callers, and let me have another caller. Seth, that's you. Go ahead.
Hi. I saw a movie, a documentary, which I think is still available on Netflix, called Very Young Girls, produced by Gems in New York. And it was in watching that movie that I learned that the average age in America of a young woman being turned out to prostitution was either 12 or 13, which I thought was horrifying. I recommend the movie highly.
Speaking about recommending movies, Seth, I just want to bring this in. I'm looking at an online comment from a listener who says, one of the biggest absurdities of the banning of prostitution is that as soon as you turn a camera on, it somehow becomes legal. But I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
But this was a documentary. And
no, I know. I just was looking at this online comment and couldn't resist it.
All right. So I wanted to say that I don't see among in the police department here any effort to go after the pimps that exploit girls who are under 18. And girls 12 or 13, to me, is horrifying. I mean, they know who the pimps are, and there's no action that I've ever heard of that's taken against them. And in addition, New York City or New York State has passed a safe harbor law, which means that a young woman who under 18 who is arrested for prostitution, well, she cannot be arrested for prostitution because she being under 18 is not permitted to consent to sex.
She's a juvenile under the law. That's right. And I'm glad you mentioned that. But, you know, here, Swanee Hunt, you mentioned that prostitution is the second biggest illegal activity, sex trafficking, that's going on. Excuse me, as I'm talking about specifically sex trafficking. And the fact of the matter is that it's easier for pimps and predators to bring children and put them in prostitution than it is bringing in drugs because they have too many. I'm sure you've heard these narratives before. Children who were told to say, "I'm a niece," or "I'm a cousin," or "I'm a daughter," or anything along those lines, and thereby essentially get through when they shouldn't be getting through because they're being brought into sex trafficking. It seems to me to be, in some ways, an extraordinary problem and one that how do we get it under rein, frankly, with policy?
I'm very taken with what one of the callers said about poverty. Because if, in fact, you orient yourself towards stemming poverty, by stopping poverty, it's a constant stream, these girls coming out of sexual abuse, foster care, et cetera. And so that's why we focus on the demand, because the idea that boys will be boys is absurd. But here's an idea that we're starting to see in different states, where when you pick up a man, you say, you know what, you have money because you have money enough to buy, so by definition. So here is your fine. And you can make that fine, like in Massachusetts, for first offense, $1,000 to $4,000. Now, that money can go into programs that are helping the women and girls who are being bought.
Okay, we call that profiting off the criminalization of prostitution. So you know, this business...
Let her finish, please, Maxine. Please.
Yeah, that becomes a virtuous circle. That is
no,
there is
that is
powerful.
Not a virtuous circle.
And, excuse me, and so I was talking to a pimp, and he said, excuse me, I was talking to an FBI agent who told me about his conversation with a pimp. He said, well, where do you get your girls? And the pimp said, well, I go to a shopping mall and I look for a girl who's walking by herself. Now, those of us who are girls know that going to a shopping mall is kind of a social event. So you find a girl walking by herself, and he said, so I go up to her and I say, hey, you know, you have beautiful eyes. And if she looks me back in the face and says, thanks, I keep going.
Well, thanks for that lesson.
The next girl and I say, hey, you've got beautiful eyes. And if she stares down at her shoes, he said, I know I've got her. That's the reality we're talking about.
But this is the problem with the policy in our country. We just allotted $1.5 billion to the prison industrial complex to criminalize people under the guise of rescuing sex trafficking victims. So there are no resources that are going into the social service net. And so what we see these nonprofits become an adjunct to the criminal industrial complex, you know, so they do these diversion programs and where people are having to go to these NGOs where they're sexually shamed or they're into forced counseling under the guise of rescuing them. And that
sounds a bit conspiratorial.
Well, it's just there's just no accountability with these NGOs.
Let me go to a Facebook comment here before we go to any more calls here. And Andrea Paul, I want to go to you on this because it raises a question that's been hovering over this conversation. It seems to me it's why I brought up all these young people that can be essentially clandestinely or under the radar brought into this country or brought into sex trafficking in general. Amanda, a listener, tweets, some sex workers are subjected to horrific abuse. Yes, but how on earth does criminalizing sex work prevent that? Andrea Paul.
Well, I agree that criminalizing sex work is not going to lessen the exploitation that those who are in a trafficking situation face. And getting back to the concept of young people, and my understanding from the amnesty proposal, there's nowhere in it does it advocate on any level that someone is under the age of 18 be involved in commercial sex. In fact, I think it directly states that that is a form of human trafficking that they oppose and have opposed for years, but getting back to those who are serving, here in the District of Columbia, we just passed legislation called the Trafficking and Minors Prevention Act, essentially Safe Harbor, which is what another caller mentioned in New York. But the challenge that we're facing, and I think Maxine kind of spoke to this, is that we're in a situation in which these young people are now being identified, which is a good thing. They need services, but we don't have the resources to provide them. We run a safe home for girls here in the district. It's the only one in the area for survivors of trafficking. And we have 6 little beds for the 100-plus girls we serve every year. And it's a very challenging situation. So when we're thinking about the concept of decriminalization, when we're thinking about the impact these policies have, I want to urge those who are listening to think about the fact that we have to think about policy in tandem with access to resources, and there's a myriad of ways that we can go about this. I'm certainly not as expert as Ambassador Hunt on what that might look like, but I just want to point out that we really need to have a deep conversation about the resources that both those who are exiting sex work and those who are staying need to have access to better their lives.
Well, we're certainly getting a lot of response from listeners on this, and I want to give more of a sampling of what you out there are saying. An email from a listener writes, until 4 years ago, I believed prostitution should be legalized and decriminalized. I now live at 18th and International in Oakland. If you want to see how prostitution and all its horror exists, drive by. 3/4 of these girls are drug addicted, under 16 years of age. They're on the street 24 hours a day. The John should be prosecuted, not these poor kids. Another listener on Facebook says, the fact is prostitution isn't illegal because of the exploitation of women. It isn't illegal to protect women to stop sex trafficking. It's illegal because of some antiquated notion of morality. There's no legal reason for prostitution to be illegal. Let me read a few more. As I say, it's a wide range of opinions. Kelly writes, there should be a distinction made between non-consenting sex slaves and self-promoting sex workers. They're a completely different trade. These are completely different trades, and the legal impact on these trades should be differentiated accordingly. If this distinction were clearly drawn, it would change the conversation. Let me read another few emails here. This is Sven from Los Angeles who writes, could the views of both your guests be true? They each bring their own experiences. Those experiences are representative of their own distinct situations. The fact is, there will always be demand for sex work, and there will always be adults willing to provide services. Neither of your guests' viewpoints should be discounted or demeaned. Both experiences should be valued as information that can be used to support legislation that can create safer environments for consenting adults. And Paul writes, we have a working model of decriminalized legal prostitution right next door in Nevada. What are the results of that? Want to comment on that, Swanee Hunt?
Well, the issue here is fueling. And when you have the demand illegal, then you're fueling the market. And you know, it's not about any one particular girl or another particular woman. You have to step back and you say, is this market a positive for our society or is it harmful? And when you have the number of people being harmed that we have, you have to say, this market needs to stop. Look what we did with smoking, okay? I mean, we told all kinds of smokers, no, actually you can't because the secondhand smoke is bad for other people. And there was tremendous pushback on that, but we impinged on the rights of the smokers to protect the non-smokers. That's basic public policy. I think that Rachel's book, Paid For, is one that ought to be on everyone's shelf. And yeah, I can't be more pleased that this book is out and about. And I hope that the listeners and those writing in will get a copy of it to get a sense of what it's like psychologically to be pulled into this trade.
Well, I want to read one more comment and get a response from you, Maxine. This is a listener who writes, Ms. Dugan represents the attitudes being groomed by the celebrity media, ignoring the majority of girls forced into the sex trade due to poverty or terrorism. She is articulate and privileged compared to the street workers I see in the Tenderloin.
Well, that, you know, this idea of privilege, I don't have access to equal protection under the law today. Out of all the people who, you know, are listening to this radio show and people who are participating in it, you know, I don't have the right to negotiate for my labor and my own safe condition. So this idea of pitting privileged people against other imaginary privileged
people. Let's do something instead of that as we conclude here. And remember that Swanee Hunt said the four of you agree on one element. That
yeah, so you can people go need to decriminalizesexwork.com, which is our website, and you can read all about our court case. And if you really care about us, you can bring us some support there.
Okay, we'll end it there. Thank you all. And Forum is produced by Irina Gucci, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.